Welcome to episode 69 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for the week of April 30th, 2007. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. On this week's episode of the Fredcast, we'll be catching up on all the racing news that we've missed since the last time we were here. Plus, there's doping news in the Ivan Basso and Floyd Landis cases, and the Discovery Channel wants you for the Tour de France. Following the news, we'll have the long-awaited review of the iBike Pro Power Meter, as well as some additional product information and listener voicemails. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Fredcast is brought to you by Cambria Bicycle Outfitter, providing quality products to bicycle consumers for over 20 years. Go to www.thefredcast.com to check out the Fredcast Picks of the Week and also to find out how you can receive free shipping on your next order. Cambria Bicycle Outfitter, they outfit the world. Well, welcome back to the Fredcast. It's great to be here. It's great to have you back with me. It's been about an extra week since I was planning on having another show. Life does sometimes get in the way of podcasting. I know I say that here a bit too much these days, but it has been a crazy year. Just a quick recap before we get into the news. The last time we were here together, we were talking about the fact that my daughter Emily and I were about to go on a cycling adventure. Now, for those of you who don't know, Emily's 10 years old, she's in fifth grade, and we did a ride across the state of California, and it was sponsored by the Rancho Panisquitos Family YMCA down in North County, San Diego. We did the ride, it was awesome, and on the next episode of the Fredcast, you will hear a complete recap of the ride, not just in my voice, but also in my daughter Emily's voice. Just a couple of notes from that ride before we get on with the news. Number one, we had a great time. Memories to last a lifetime, as you can imagine. It was absolutely fantastic. We met some great people, both the parents and the kids, and the people who put this ride on are second to none. They know how to make sure that everybody is well taken care of and that each one of those kids who started that ride very close to the Arizona-Mexico-California border made it all the way to the Pacific Ocean. It was a great week, a great ride. So stay tuned to the Fredcast next week when you'll hear the entire recap of that ride. Until then, I have posted a lot of pictures on the Fredcast website of our ride. If you want to go and take a look at those, and there's some pretty fun ones there, it's www.thefredcast.com. And when you get to the homepage, look up at the top of the screen and you'll see a number of tabs. Click on the photos link, and then I think it should be self-explanatory from there. By the way, one of the last photos there that I think you'll find pretty funny, I decided not to shave the entire week, and that's the last photo in the set. It's the scruffy, all-too-gray beard on David, your host of the Fredcast. Go ahead and check that out. In the meantime, it's time to get into the Fredcast and time to get into the news. Well, there is a lot going on in the cycling news, especially over the last 2 weeks, and it was very difficult for me to pick a top story this week, so I've just decided I'm going to start with the racing news, head through the doping news, and get to the rest of the general interest cycling news. So hang on, there's a lot of racing news to come, and let's start with the last thing that I teased on the last Fredcast, and that is the Hell of the North, the Paris-Roubaix. Well, as I was driving down to the Arizona-California border for the ride across California, I was following exactly what was going on in the Paris-Roubaix race, and I was, well, stunned. I don't think that's the right word, but I was certainly really pleased to see that the winner of this year's Paris-Roubaix was Stuart O'Grady from Australia. Congratulations to Stuart. He is the first Australian to win the Hell of the North, the Queen of the Classics, Paris-Roubaix, one of typically the most grueling and difficult races, especially of the spring cycling season. This year's race, 259.5 kilometers, and O'Grady broke away about 23 kilometers from the finish, finally finishing the race in first place in 6 hours, 9 minutes, and 7 seconds. Now, last year's winner, Fabian Cancellara, is O'Grady's CSC teammate. And according to a report that I read, O'Grady said, quote, "I spoke to Fabian quickly, and he said he wasn't feeling 100%. I saw that Vesemann was going pretty strong, and after that, there was no holding back. It's a dream, and I can hardly believe it. This is the first race I ever saw on video back home years and years ago. So this is a fantastic race for him, a great ride for him." And one of the things that we should point out about O'Grady's win at Paris-Roubaix this year is that O'Grady began his cycling career as a track cyclist. And what's really great about this race is it finishes on a track. As a matter of fact, he said, quote, "Track is where I was born. And since this finishes on a cycling track, I told myself, why not?" Now, the last time we were here on the Fredcast, I told you that the race favorite was Belgium's Tom Bonin, and he won the race back in 2005. He ended up taking sixth place this year, 55 seconds behind Stuart O'Grady. Congratulations to CSC, to Stuart O'Grady, the first Australian ever to win Paris-Roubaix. By the way, it should also be noted, if you've been watching Paris-Roubaix in years past, you know how awful the weather can be there and how treacherous the cobble sections or the pavé sections can be at this race. This year, there was none of that. Of course, the cobbles are always treacherous, whether it's wet or dry. But this year, it was sunny and dry. And I think that that made for an easier race for a lot of the racers because, of course, those cobbles can get very slippery and very, very difficult to navigate for a lot of the cyclists. So it was a sunny day, it was a nice day, and it was Stuart O'Grady's day. Well, just a week later was the Amstel Gold race. Now, of course, a lot of us know that the words Amstel Gold as being the name of a beer, and of course, Amstel comes from Holland. Holland is typically known for having very flat, very open roads. And of course, while the Amstel Gold race does take place in Holland, it takes place in a area of Holland known as the Valkenburg, which is much more hilly than the rest of Holland. It's in the south of the Netherlands. This is a 250 kilometer race. It goes twisting and turning through the countryside. It includes 30 short climbs, as opposed to a lot of the longer climbs that you'd see on some of the longer tours toward the end of the cycling season. Now, in 2006, it was won by Frank Schleck of Luxembourg from Team CSC. And of course, Schleck was looking this year to try to repeat and win the race. This year, however, the winner was Stefan Schumacher from Gerolsteiner. He won, well, basically he took it with 3 kilometers left when he powered away from 6 other riders. Second place went to David Rebellin, who is Schumacher's Gerolsteiner teammate, and in third place from Leaky Gas, Danilo De Luca. It should be noted that last year's winner, Frank Schleck, actually crashed in the middle of the race, but he was able to power back into the peloton, ending up in 9th place, 1 minute and 7 seconds behind Schumacher. And you're probably all going to start thinking that I'm sounding a bit like your TV weatherman, but it should be noted that, you know, this time of the year, the weather can be a little iffy in this part of Northern Europe, in the whole Benelux region of Northern Europe. And this year at the Amstel Gold Race, it was a balmy 70 degrees when the race started. So certainly the weather gods are behind the Pro Peloton this year, providing them with good weather for the spring classics and for a lot of this great spring racing. And while we're talking about warm temperatures in Northern Europe, let's talk about the next race that was on the Pro Tour calendar, and that's La Flèche Wallonne, which took place on April the 25th, just 3 days after the Amstel Gold race. This is one of those midweek races, and it's one of the shorter classic races on the calendar every year. But this race that goes through Belgium is also one of the ones that you know, I hate to say this because it may sound politically incorrect, but it separates the men from the boys. And the reason for that is a very famous climb in professional cycling, and I'm going to butcher the name, but it's the Mur du Huy, or probably the Mur du Huy. I'm not sure which. It doesn't matter. This climb is tough, and it gets steeper and steeper as you get closer to the top, and the riders had to endure it 3 times. For the final climb up this hill, the finish is at the very end. And last year's defending champion was Alejandro Valverde. 2005's defending champion was Danilo De Luca. But this year's Flèche Wallonne was won by David Rebellin from Gerolsteiner. Name sound familiar? He took second in Amstel Gold behind his teammate Schumacher. In the end of the 202.5-kilometer race, it was Rebellin in first place. And this is going to sound very interesting. The reason why I made such a big deal about who the defending champions were, because in second place was Alejandro Valverde, 2006's winner, and in third, Danilo De Luca, who was 2005's winner. An exciting race, once again in warm temperatures, and congratulations to Gerolsteiner for their second win of the week, and to David Rebellin for winning, and at that point, taking over control of the Pro Tour points so far for 2007. Now, of course, as is par for the course here on the Fredcast, I'm probably mispronouncing the name of this race. I keep calling it La Flèche Wallonne. It's probably La Flèche Wallonne because what it means is the Arrow of Walloon, and Walloon is a region of Belgium on the eastern section of Belgium, very close to Germany. And the Mur de Huy, or the Mur de Huy, or however you say it, is that means the Wall of Huy, and that is that very steep climb that the riders have to endure 3 times on this race. And what makes it difficult, as I said earlier, is the fact that it gets steeper and steeper as it gets to that finish after the 3rd climb of this hill. And we're talking about sections that can be in excess of 15% grade. That's a tough hill. One final note from this year's Flèche Wallonne, and that is that by Rebellin beating Alejandro Valverde, unfortunately, he spoiled Valverde's birthday, because indeed, April 25th is the birthday of Alejandro Valverde, and that's the day that Rebellin beat him. So, happy birthday to Valverde. Unfortunately, you're going to have to settle for second place this year in La Flèche Wallonne. And just 4 days after La Flèche Wallonne came the next race on the Pro Tour calendar, and the last one that we're going to talk about tonight, and that is Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and this was on April the 29th, just a couple of days ago. Now, this race is one of the last of the Ardennes classics for the spring season every year, and it was first held in 1892 and has become known as La Doyenne, being the oldest classic on the cycling calendar. This is an out-and-back race through the Ardennes Forest of Belgium, and it is a difficult race because they have to go over a series of ever more difficult hills. Now, in 2006, it was won by a very familiar name, Alejandro Valverde. This year, it was won by another very familiar name, one that we've heard a lot this year, and we've certainly heard a lot tonight. The names that were in the final of this year's Liège-Bastogne-Liège are names that we have heard a lot tonight. And this year it was won by Danilo De Luca, coming in first place. Now remember, in 2005, De Luca won the Amstel Gold and the Flèche Wallonne. This year he's now won the 3rd of the big Ardennes classics, and of course that's Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Coming in first place, Danilo De Luca. Second place went to Alejandro Valverde, again, another familiar name. And third, remember we talked about Frank Schleck in the last story, and we mentioned the fact that he had had a crash in the Amstel Gold race. He actually broke his rib in that crash. Nevertheless, he was able to come in third place in this year's Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And oh yes, in case you were wondering if I was going to miss mentioning it, the weather was hot and windy at this year's Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So with those 3 races behind the Pro Peloton for this year, so far the Pro Tour standings look like this. In first place, David Rebellin with 157 points. In second, Alejandro Valverde with 107 points. And in third, Danilo De Luca with 100 points. As far as team standings for this year's Pro Tour, right now in first place is Team CSC with 152 points. In second place, Liquigas with 146 points. And in third, the Discovery Channel Pro Cycling Team with 132 points. Now, coming up next on the Pro Tour calendar, May 1st through the 6th, That starting today is the Tour de Romandie, and I will have a complete report on that Swiss race coming up for you on the next edition of the Fredcast, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's talk about a little bit of American stage racing, and let's talk about the Tour of Georgia. The Tour of Georgia took place April 16th through the 22nd in the southeastern state of Georgia here in the United States of California, and it was yet another return of the Pro Peloton to the United States. It included both European Pro Tour teams as well as domestic continental Pro Tour teams, and this one was all Discovery. Now, Stage 1, which took place on April the 16th, went from Peachtree City to Macon, Georgia, and it saw the return of both Tyler Hamilton and George Hincapie. Hincapie, of course, who was injured in a crash at the Tour of California several months ago, which we've talked about here on the show, which left him unable to participate in the typical spring classics that he knows and loves so well. But it was good to see George back racing again, and the return of Tyler Hamilton, the first time that he has raced on the professional circuit here in the United States since his two-year suspension on doping charges, and now his return to the Tinkoff Credit Systems Continental Pro Tour team. Stage 1 was won by Daniel Contrini, Tyler's Tinkoff teammate. Second place in the stage went to Doug Olerenshaw from the HealthNet Maxis team, and third went to Mike Sayers from the BMC team. One note from Stage 1 is that Discovery Channel's Jason McCartney, who did play a pivotal role in this year's Tour of California in helping Levi Leipheimer win that event, ended up not being able to start this year due to having the flu. And so as a result, unfortunately, Jason was left out of the Discovery Channel lineup for this year's Tour of Georgia. Now, Stage 2 was a 135-mile event that went from Thomaston to Rome, Georgia, not the one in Italy, folks, and it was won by Ivan Stevic from the Toyota United team, second place going to J.J. Hayato of Team CSC, and third, Fast Freddy Rodriguez. Now, interestingly enough, in sixth place, there was Discovery's Levi Leipheimer. So Discovery was already starting to have quite the showing this year, especially when you look at 10th place going to Tom Danielson, 11th place going to George Hincapie. So George seems to be back in shape and ready to challenge the best of them. It looked that way after Stage 2 of this year's Tour of Georgia. And at the end of this stage, Stage 2, Contrini retained the yellow leader's jersey for this year's Tour of Georgia, but all of that was about to change thanks to, again, Team Discovery. Next up was Stage 3, which was a 118-mile course from Rome, Georgia to Chattanooga, Tennessee. This stage was won by Discovery's Gianni Miersman. Second place went to David Garcia Cañada, and third went to Discovery's Janic Brockovic. Now, Brockovic was not originally planned to be as part of the Discovery Channel's team at this year's Tour of Georgia. Originally, it was supposed to be Jose Rubiera who was going to be on the team when Rubiera got sick at the last moment. Brockovic came in and took his place, and by the end of Stage 3, it was looking like Brockovic had a good chance of winning the entire event, the whole Tour of Georgia this year. Now, when it came to Stage 4, which was an individual time trial, and that went from Chickamauga, Walker County to Lookout Mountain, it was won by none other than Discovery's Levi Leipheimer. Leipheimer finished the event in 44 minutes and 51 seconds. Second place, American Dave Zabriskie from Team CSC. Third, Nathan O'Neill from Team HealthNet Maxis. Fourth, Discovery's Tom Danielson. Fifth, Dominique Cornu from Predictor Lotto. And they're in eighth place, again, another Discovery Channel member, and looking like his form is definitely coming back, George Hincapie in 47 minutes and 6 seconds. At the end of this stage, Janic Brockovic, who was not expected and not supposed to be at this year's Tour of Georgia, took over the overall lead and the yellow jersey in the general classification for this year's Tour of Georgia. And at the end of that, it looked like it was almost assured that Brockovic would actually win the entire event this year. On April 20th came Stage 5 of this year's Tour of Georgia, and this is the famed Brasstown Bald finish. It goes from Dalton, Georgia to Brasstown Bald, which has become legendary, at least in American cycling, as being one of those great uphill finishes that everybody at the end of the Tour of California was really hoping for and hoping that they'd see on a future Tour of California. This was a 107-mile stage, and it was won, once again, by Discovery's Levi Leipheimer. Second place went to Discovery's Tom Danielson. Third, Anthony Colby from Colavita Olive Oil Sutter Home. Fourth, Nathan O'Neill from HealthNet Maxis. And fifth went to Gilberto Simoni from Sonier Duval. At the end of the race, Leipheimer said, "I felt great, and Tom," meaning Tom Danielson, "was gracious enough to let me win Brasstown this year." And who retained the overall lead was none other than Janusz Brockovic. And what Brockovic's strategy was on this particular stage was to make sure that he stayed with the second place rider so far in this year's race, which is Christian Vandevelde from CSC. According to Brockovic, quote, "I just tried to focus on staying on his wheel. He attacked at least 20 times, and there were times that I was suffering, but I was able to stay with him until the end, and that's all that matters." So after stage five, Brockovic looked almost assured, as I said after the last stage, to retain the lead all the way into the final stage and win the overall in this year's race. Saturday's stage six was a 113.5-mile course that ended just before the metro area of Atlanta, and this one was won by Fast Freddy Rodriguez from the Predictor Lotto team in 4 hours, 4 minutes flat. And this is the first time Rodriguez has won a stage in a race since last year when he won stage four at the Tour of Georgia. Having won this stage, Freddy Rodriguez now stands alone as having won the most stages of the Tour of Georgia. Second place went to J.J. Hiato from CSC, and third, George Hincapie from Discovery Channel. At the end of the race, Janusz Brockovic finished with the peloton to retain his 12-second lead over Christian Vandevelde from Team CSC, leaving only Sunday's 67-mile circuit race around the city of Atlanta standing between a podium and Janusz Brockovic. And indeed, that's exactly what happened on Stage 7. Stage 7 was won by Team CSC's J.J. Hiato, but at the end of the race, it was Janusz Brockovic at the top of the podium. Second place going to Christian Vandevelde from Team CSC, and third place went to Sonier Duval rider David Cañada Garcia. In the end, the Tour of Georgia for 2007 turned out to be very exciting and very, very good for Team Discovery, especially for Janusz Brockovic. But let's not leave out George Hincapie and seeing how well he did in this year's race, and especially Levi Leipheimer winning two stages back to back. It was a great event, and I think that as a footnote, it should be mentioned, I've talked several times here on the show about the fact that they lost their title sponsor for the Tour of Georgia. You'll recall that it used to be the Ford Tour of Georgia, and that AT&T stepped up this year with $500,000 sponsorship of the event. By all accounts, AT&T was very pleased with the results that they got off of sponsoring the event, and I'm hopeful, and I know that a lot of you cycling fans are also hopeful, that AT&T and perhaps others will step up even more in 2008 so that the Tour of Georgia can continue and will remain one of North America's premier cycling races. So it was a great event. Looking forward to next year. Well, as much as I hate to bring up this subject, it does seem to follow racing these days everywhere it goes. And of course, you know what that subject is. It's time for the doping news. You'll recall that Ivan Basso was barred from participating in last year's Tour de France over possible allegations that he was involved in the Operation Puerto affair that took place in Spain. We've talked about that many, many times on the show. The Italian Olympic Committee decided to reopen their investigation into Basso and his possible involvement in the Puerto affair, and as a result, last week, Basso was sidelined by the Discovery Channel Pro Cycling team. Well, just a few days ago, Basso asked to be released from his contract with Discovery so that he wouldn't distract from the team and that the team could then continue on this season without him. And that is exactly what Discovery allowed him to do. So as of right now, Ivan Basso is a man without a team and a man who is defending himself against doping allegations, and Discovery no longer has the cycling great Ivan Basso on their team. I'm sure that this story has much more before the final chapter is written, and of course I'll keep you posted, but it is sad to see that Ivan Basso is no longer a part of professional cycling at the moment, and especially that he's no longer a part of the Discovery Channel Pro Cycling team. Now, there are some of you who might be saying, well, it sort of serves Discovery right. The writing was on the wall. When they signed Ivan Basso late last year, there were a lot of other Pro Tour teams who were very upset because they felt that Discovery had violated sort of a gentleman's agreement that said that any rider who was under investigation at the time would not be signed by a Pro Tour team. So I think that there are probably people out there who are saying, you know what, it serves Discovery right. But on the other hand, at the moment, these are just allegations. And it is sad to see that this is still occurring in the sport of professional cycling, and we'll see what happens with Ivan Basso in the near future. Meanwhile, the doping case that seems to have the entire world captivated is the one that has to do with American cyclist Floyd Landis. You'll recall that the last time we met here on the Fredcast, I mentioned to you the fact that Floyd's backup samples were indeed going to be tested again by the very same lab in France that gave the positive tests after stage 17 of the 2006 Tour de France. According to the French sports newspaper L'Equipe, they are now reporting that tests on seven so-called B samples showed traces of the banned substance synthetic testosterone in the tests that it performed. Now, for their part, obviously, the Floyd Landis camp has been saying all along that they didn't feel that it was proper that the same lab that gave the positive results, the same lab that the Landis camp questions because of their procedures, and more specifically, Landis has said that they are not following proper procedures. They've been upset that that same lab tested the samples again. As a matter of fact, they had requested that the lab at the University of California at Los Angeles, or UCLA, test the samples, and that was denied. Another problem that the Landis camp has is that the Landis designated expert who was supposed to be verifying and observing the tests at this French lab was not allowed into the lab during the tests. And the French lab's defense for that is that the USADA representatives were not there. And because the USADA representatives weren't there, and of course that stands for the United States Anti-Doping Agency, because those representatives weren't there, Landis's representative was unescorted and therefore couldn't participate in observing the tests. Now, these results have not been verified. This is only something that's been reported in L'Equipe, and I'm sure that we will hear more about this as Floyd gets closer to his May 14th hearing in front of the United States Anti-Doping Agency. But if true, it does not bode well for the Landis defense. On the other hand, the Landis defense has been that this lab has not been following the proper procedures, so that, therefore, any results that came out of this lab should be invalidated. And I think that that's a reasonable thing if indeed the lab has not been following the proper procedures. Meanwhile, Lance Armstrong appears to be standing firmly behind Floyd Landis on criticizing the lab. Lance was recently quoted as saying, quote, "I think it's a good tactic to share that information with the public. I believe in Floyd. I believe he hasn't had a fair shake, and I don't trust the lab." So I think that that's a great thing for Floyd Landis to have somebody of Lance Armstrong's stature and reputation standing behind him on criticizing the lab. Meanwhile, the lab itself and French anti-doping authorities have now asked outside experts to verify that this French lab has correctly handled the tests that caused the furor over the Floyd Landis situation. According to Pierre Bordry, who is the director of the French anti-doping agency, quote, "What interests me is the positive B sample from August. I've asked experts outside of the affair to tell me if the analyses of these samples were conducted correctly." It'd be interesting to see what they find out and whether or not they find any wrongdoing on the part of the lab. Meanwhile, as if to make this an even more confused situation and make things look even stranger, BikeBiz.com is now reporting that the lab at the center of the Floyd Landis case is now said to have wiped their computer data on the isotope ratio mass spectrometry tests that they conducted on Floyd's urine samples from stage 17. If that is the case, then I think it points even further to some malfeasance and some mishandling of all of the evidence in the Floyd Landis case. And if that is proven, then I think that it makes Floyd's case even stronger. We are getting closer to the final conclusion of this case. Again, Floyd's hearing is on May the 14th. We'll just have to wait and see what happens in that hearing and with the final conclusion of Floyd's case. Meanwhile, speaking of sports magazines from Europe, the Italian sports magazine La Gazzetta dello Sport has now reported that a total of 107 cyclists are in some way connected with the Operation Puerto affair. And they're basing that information on what's called the full dossier of over 6,000 pages, which apparently goes into much, much more detail than the 39-page summary that was released at the end of June 2006 or the 500-page preliminary report. And the Tour de France has now said that any riders that are implicated in that Spanish doping scandal have now been told that they will not be welcome at this year's Tour de France. According to race director Christian Prudhomme, quote, cycling can't afford to let riders in the case enter the Tour if they're not cleared of suspicion. This case is far-reaching. It will go on for quite some time. Eventually, I'm hoping that professional cycling will be cleared of this very, very dark shadow. In the meantime, Operation Puerto and all of these other doping scandals are overshadowing the great things that are happening in professional cycling. I mean, look at the great races that we've had all this year. If you talk to the general public, the casual cycling fan or the non-cycling fan, they don't look at all of these great races. They don't look at all these amazing athletes. All they think about is blood doping, hypodermic needles, and testosterone. By the way, parenthetically, you may recall that when I was at the Tour of California, I interviewed Dave Shields, the author of two great cycling books, The Race and The Tour. I finished both of Dave's books, and if you want great insight into what is going on in the professional peloton, especially as concerns the pressure on riders for doping, I highly, highly encourage you to read The Race and then read The Tour. The Race just looks at the professional peloton and is a great look into what goes on there. And The Tour looks at the pressure on riders to perform and the pressure to use illegal doping products. Dave has not been a member of the professional peloton, but I think that he's got great insight. I enjoyed his books immensely, and I think that you would too. I've put a link in the show notes if you're interested in checking those out again. Again, I get nothing for mentioning this other than the fact that I think that you'll enjoy the books and that I think it'll give you a new perspective on this entire doping situation in professional sports. Hey, speaking of the Tour de France, have you always wanted to go to the Tour de France? And have you wanted to report on it for, oh, I don't know, a major TV network? Well, Discovery HD Theaters Discovery Club 1080 is looking for two cycling enthusiasts to star in an upcoming program. Now, if you're selected for this, you will end up getting to travel to Spain to meet Discovery Channel's riders and coaches, and then they're going to show you everything about training for the Tour de France before they send you home, where the Discovery Club 1080 cameras are going to follow you as you continue to train out on your own at home. Then you get to go back to France to do some of the hardest stages of this year's Tour de France. If you're interested, if this sounds like an amazing experience to you as it does to me, here's what you need to do. You need to send a video to Discovery showing, quote, that you've got what it takes. In order to do this, you've got to get the video done and uploaded by May the 4th. That just gives you a couple of days. They're going to accept videos in AVI, MOV, WMV, MPEG-4, MP3, WMA, AIF, and WAV formats. So that sounds to me like they're looking for video or audio. I can do audio. If you're interested in taking part in this and entering into this contest, which sounds incredible, check out the show notes. I've given you a link where you too can go on and apply for this program. It sounds great. Good luck. If you're chosen, let me know because I'd love to cover it here on the Fredcast. There's an interesting report on the Times Online, and I've put a link in the show notes to the entire article. The report suggests that female cyclists, now this report comes from London, but it suggests that female cyclists are far more likely to be killed by a truck, or of course there they call it a lorry, because, and this is the interesting part, unlike men, they tend to obey red lights and wait at intersections in the driver's blind spot. Now, according to the report which is obtained by the Times Online, it suggests that some cyclists who break the law by jumping red lights may actually be safer, and that bike lanes may actually make the problem worse. It's an interesting study and one which currently is being withheld, and the Times happened to get a copy of it, but it's one which I would like to see released, and hopefully we can get some good debate on it. I'm hoping that we can talk about this on the next episode of The Spokesman, because it really presents some interesting findings and also some interesting challenges, because for those of us who do believe in waiting for lights and not running red lights, does that make us less safe? The situation here, remember, of course, they drive on the left in England. Situation here typically was that the riders were waiting in the truck's blind spot on the left-hand side of the road, and then the truck would then go to make a left-hand turn when the light turned green, and that's when the problems would occur. Now, the Times Online does list a couple of items which it considers its road survival code, and it says, advice to cyclists on how to avoid collisions with lorries. Number one, if a lorry is in front of you, wait where you can see the mirrors until it's possible to pass it. Number two, you should pass a lorry only on the right. Now, if that's in the United States, you should pass only on the left. And when you are sure you have enough time and space to get far enough ahead for the driver to see you clearly before they start moving. Number three, if a lorry is behind you, ride where the driver has to consider your presence. Next, ride where lorries cannot pass you or cannot pass you without changing their position on the road. Women cyclists are more likely to put themselves in danger by adopting a don't worry about me, I'm not really here attitude. And I think that that's a good point. So again, I put a link in the show notes to where you can see the full article, and hopefully we'll discuss this on next week's edition of The Spokesman, so be sure to tune into that, and that's at www.the-spokesman.com. It's an interesting study. I can't wait till it's released because I think that it should get broad coverage, and therefore we should get a lot more discussion of its findings. And the final story in the news this week also comes to us from jolly old England, and this is one that says that a bicycle, which was ridden by Princess Diana when she was a child, is now going to be auctioned off next month. The bike was owned by the Princess of Wales when she lived in Althorp, Northamptonshire in the 70s, and it's a tracker bike being sold by Keys Auctioneers on 18th May. The bicycle was purchased later by a housekeeper who was employed by Princess Diana's family. The housekeeper died and her family has now decided to sell the bike. I've put a link in the show notes to where you can find the information about the auction, just in case you too would like your little prince or princess to ride one of Princess Diana's former bicycles. And with that bit of royal news, here ends the news for this week on the Fredcast.
May is National Bike Month. Now, I used to be intimidated at the thought of biking to work. I worried about my outfit, the traffic, and the time. But my expanding waistline and rising gas prices helped me rethink that position. And last May, I tried riding to work. What an amazing change. In the years since I started riding to work, I've lost weight, saved money on gas, and canceled my gym membership. You should try it. Here are a few tips to help you get started. Alter your route for biking. Cars and bikes are both vehicles and both have a right to the road, but you'll feel more comfortable and more able to enjoy your ride if you choose less traveled streets. Ride with a friend the first few times. Someone who has experience biking to work. They'll help you figure out how to carry your clothes, where to park your bike, and the easiest way to get to the office. Follow all the same rules you follow while driving. Signal before you turn, stop at all stop signs, and stay in the rightmost lane going in your direction. Biking to work is fun, easy, and enjoyable. Try it. For more tips and techniques on how to commute by bicycle or to find other cyclists in your area, visit bikeleague.org.
That's right. May is National Bike Month here in the United States. And for more information, you can go to the National Bike Month website. And I've put a link in the show notes. Bike to Work Week is May the 14th through the 18th. And Bike to Work Day is May 18th. And that's a Friday. If you'd like to read about 50 ways to celebrate National Bike Month, check out the show notes where you can download the PDF document, 50 Ways to Celebrate National Bike Month. So get out there and ride. It's bike month, and try to get more of your friends riding. Try to consider cycle commuting. The weather has turned here in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's gotten much, much nicer. What could be better than riding your bike to work or down to the store or wherever you might normally consider taking a car trip? Let's all do our part to celebrate National Bike Month for May. Well, many of you have been asking me, what happened to your reviews of the power meters? And I mentioned on the last show that I had a couple of delays in getting some products and a couple of issues with some of the products and making sure that they were set up properly. But I am now finally pleased to be bringing you the first in our series of power meter reviews. And this week's review is of the iBike Pro power meter. Now, before we get into the review and even talk about the product itself, I think it's important that you understand that every single one of the power meters that I'm going to be reviewing over the next couple of weeks and months all perform their power calculations in different ways. We've seen power meters that measure the force on the chain, power meters that are built into the rear hub, power meters that are built into the bottom bracket or into the cranks. The iBike Pro, I honestly believe, is perhaps one of the most innovative methods of measuring power that's available out there. Now remember, let's talk about Newton's laws for a second. We all know Sir Isaac Newton. He had the three basic laws of physics, and his third law says, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And the designers of the iBike Pro took that very much into account. You see, because the iBike does not attach to any of those areas that we've just discussed, the iBike instead looks at the forces that are exerted on a bike ride. It looks at everything from the slope on which the bike is placed. It looks at the wind speed. It looks at the speed of the bike. It looks at all sorts of different factors in order to calculate how much power the rider is putting into the pedal strokes. So, for instance, the iBike Pro uses four sensors in order to figure out how much power is being generated by you, the rider. It uses an accelerometer to measure the slope of the hill, as well as the bike's acceleration and deceleration forces. It then uses a differential pressure sensor to measure the wind speed. It then uses an absolute pressure sensor to measure elevation gain. And then finally, it uses a speed sensor on the front wheel to measure the bike speed. Now, there's two versions of the iBike Pro. The standard iBike Pro, which retails for about $399, simply includes the iBike, the speed sensor, a cable to connect it to your computer, and, of course, the necessary software. Then there's the iBike Pro Cadence, which retails for about $488, and that adds a cadence sensor. Now, before we get into how the iBike works specifically and my review of it, I want to let you know that it's my personal recommendation that if you can afford the extra money for the cadence sensor, having used a non-cadence sensor iBike Pro and now having used a cadence sensor iBike Pro, my recommendation would be to check out the one that includes the cadence sensor. The reason for that is, obviously, I've told you before, I like convergence. I like being able to see as much information on the computer screen on my bike as possible. So one reason is I like being able to look down, see my bike speed, see my cadence, and see my power being generated all in one place. And of course, there's a ton of other information. We'll talk about that in a moment. But I like being able to see all of that on the screen. The other reason that I like the iBike Pro with the cadence sensor is because when the cadence sensor is applied As soon as you stop pedaling, the iBike Pro knows that you're no longer applying power to the pedals, and your power figure now goes down to zero. Otherwise, the iBike Pro has to calculate the power that you're putting into the pedals. And if you're descending, it takes a little bit of time for the iBike Pro to realize that you're no longer pedaling if you're coasting downhill. And it takes a little bit longer for the iBike bike to realize that it needs to bring that power number down to zero. Well, let's talk a little bit about setting up your iBike Pro when you first get it. The iBike Pro comes with a handlebar mount and a speed sensor, and optionally, the cadence sensor, as I mentioned a few moments ago. The first thing that you need to do is you need to figure out where you're mounting the iBike Pro on your handlebars. And by the way, before you make your purchase, you need to determine whether or not this is being mounted on a standard diameter handlebar, an oversized diameter handlebar, or on a time trial bike, and you can order specific mounts for each of those situations. Now, once you've determined where you want to put the iBike Pro on your handlebar, and you need to make sure that you've tried to put it as parallel with the ground as possible or as horizontal as possible, now you've got a few things you need to do. Number one, you need to make sure that you route the cable onto the front fork, as with any normal bike computer. And this is where a tip comes in for you. One of the things that I found in my testing, in order to make sure that the iBike Pro is as accurate as possible, is that contrary to a lot of other cycle computers that you may have put on a bike before, where you put the speed sensor relatively close to the hub and you put it down near the end of the front fork, when it comes to the iBike Pro, in order to make sure that you get an accurate reading, it's actually preferred that you put the speed sensor higher up on the fork and closer to the rim as opposed to being closer to the hub. So keep that in mind if you get an iBike Pro. You'll get a much better reading, much more accurate reading, and you won't get any strange spikes in the data that's finally produced. So you route the cable. When you mount the iBike Pro on your handlebars, it is absolutely critical that you mount it in such a way that it will not move. It has to be, as the manual says, rock solid. And one of the ways that you make sure that you do that is the iBike folks include a couple of pieces of double sticky backed foam tape, the kind of tape that you might use to mount something like a poster on a wall, or that you might use to put a ribbon on a present, say for Christmas or for somebody's birthday. You must put this underneath the mount because it helps maintain the rock solid firm grip of the iBike on your handlebars. Then, of course, if you get the cadence sensor, you then have to run that cable back to your rear chainstay and then put the sensors on your spoke or on your crank of your bicycle. Now you've done the mechanical setup. Now there's some calibration that you need to do so that the iBike is able to make the proper calculations of power. The first thing that you need to do is what's called a tilt calibration. Because of the way that the iBike works and because it measures hill slope, it needs to know what level is. And in order to do that, what you do is you take your bike with the iBike and you place it on a relatively level surface and you mark the place on the ground where your wheels are located. You then tell the iBike, okay, it's level, and then you hold the iBike straight. And when a few seconds have gone by, the iBike will tell you, turn the bike 180 degrees and repeat the calibration. You can then check your work, and once you've made sure that it now knows what level is, you move on to the next step. The next step is to make sure that the wind sensor is calibrated properly. Simply take your bike, stand in your garage where there's no wind, and then you calibrate the fact that you're in a no-wind environment. By the way, something that's mentioned in the manual, but which bears repeating, and which I think could probably be spelled out in greater detail as far as its importance in the manual, you need to do this wind calibration before every single ride in order to make sure that the wind calculation within the iBike and that your power calculation within the iBike is as accurate as possible. So if you get an iBike, just remember that you need to do the wind calibration before every single ride. It literally will take you 30 seconds, so it's not that big of a deal. Once you've done that, you then need to go out and do what is probably the most important calibration, which is called the coast down. And that consists of starting from zero on a flat to slightly uphill road with as few bumps as possible. You then press a button to begin the calibration and you accelerate up to 20 miles an hour. When you get to 20 miles an hour, the iBike will tell you. You then stop pedaling, don't touch your brakes, and then coast down to 8 miles an hour. What the iBike is doing is it's then calculating a friction coefficient, and it's also calculating an aero coefficient so that it can figure out what forces are acting against you on the bike. Now, before you've done all of this, you've entered in your weight and the bike's weight, and it uses those numbers along with what it senses while you're doing your coast down to figure out what the frictional and what the wind coefficients are working against you and your bike and your body. Once you've done that, the iBike is set up and it's ready for you to go out and use on a ride. So let's now talk about my experiences of using the iBike on a ride. The first thing you'll notice about the iBike is that it works and looks very much like any other cycle computer in that it gives you your current speed, it tracks the distance that you've ridden, it shows you your cadence if you have the cadence sensor equipped iBike, but then it gives you all sorts of other very useful information, especially for us Freds. So obviously, of course, the first thing it gives you is your power. And I have to tell you, although I'm not currently working with a coach, remember we spoke with Coach Rich Wharton several weeks ago, and he talked about the value of training with power when you're working with a coach. Now, I'm not currently working with a coach, but I have found that in my few weeks of using the iBike, when I get out on a ride, even though I haven't had a coach tell me where I should be as far as my power output, that I've actually been working harder because I look down and I look at what my power output is. And if I'm just coasting along at, say, 100 watts, I'm not working very hard. And so it's challenging me to work even harder. Last weekend, for instance, I did a ride around the Palos Verdes Peninsula here in the Los Angeles area. And there are a number of hills, both up and down. And I found that while I had ridden that course before, I did it faster on this ride, probably because I was continually challenging myself to maintain a consistently higher power output level, whether I was going uphill or even when I was going downhill. So I know that if I'm working with a coach and I'm getting a prescribed power output level, I'm probably going to be working smarter, but I've already found that working with power is challenging me to train harder. Personally, I like that. Some of the other information that the iBike will give you, of course, it tracks the amount of calories that you've burned. And this is the very first time when I have felt that the calorie reading on a cycle computer is actually accurate. Because calories, of course, are a measure of work. Power is a measure of work. So if it knows how much I weigh, how much my bike weighs, if it knows the distance I've gone, and it knows how much power I've put into the pedals, it's actually giving me an accurate readout of how many calories I've burned. I like that. It will also give me the air temperature, and of course, it will also track the elevation gain as I ride. Another thing that it will do, and I've never seen this on any other cycle computer before, it's got the wind sensor that I talked about earlier, so that it will tell me and measure my headwind and my tailwind. That's something that I've never had before, something I wish I had on the ride across California, but I didn't have the iBike attached to my mountain bike when I did that ride. That is very useful information because, of course, we always all think that we have a headwind, and that's why today's ride was so difficult. Now you really know what the wind effects are as you go out on your ride. That's a feature that I really like about the iBike. Now, the iBike has a couple of really cool features that I've never seen in another cycle computer before. One of the first ones is, let's say you're riding on the flats and then you see a steep hill ahead. Once you start climbing, you always want to know not only how much power that you're outputting, not only you want to know what your cadence is and what your speed is, For me, I also like to know how steep the hill is. There's a great setting that you can put into the iBike so that anytime you get onto a hill that has a greater than 2% gradient, the top window on the main screen will automatically alternate between your speed and the hill slope. And then once it drops below 2% again, it goes back to just showing the speed. They call this the auto hill feature, and it's something that I've used and I really like. There's also a feature in here that's really cool. Now, normally the iBike screen displays the information about what they call your trip. In other words, that particular ride. And it stores that data in memory. But let's say you start a ride from home, and then after 10 or 15 miles, you end up meeting some friends and you start riding with them, and maybe they're a little bit slower than you. Well, you can set what's called a sub trip so that while it's all part of the same ride, you'll be able to compare once you get home and you connect it to your computer, you'll be able to compare how you were doing when you were out on your own versus how you were doing when you were with your friends that you were riding with. And that way you'll be able to have statistics for both your harder riding as well as for your easier riding. You can also set up intervals on your computer so that the iBike will then be able to lead you through interval training. And one of the things that's really nice and something I haven't seen on another cycle computer that I've used is that, and this happens all the time, you're in the middle of an interval and then before you know it, you hit a stop sign or a stoplight and you have to pause your interval. With other cycle computers that I've used before, you're stuck and the interval runs out on your computer and you really have to start all over again. With the iBike, you can pause your interval and then once you get through the green light or you get through the intersection, you can resume the interval that you had started earlier. That's a feature that I really like. The iBike stores your data in what's called non-volatile RAM. And what that means is that if your battery should run out, you will not lose your data. And that's a good thing. And the iBike can store alternately either 50 hours of data storage or 10 hours of data storage, depending on whether it's retaining information at 1 second intervals or 5 second intervals. I personally have it set for 1 second intervals so that that way I retain the most information that I can so that when I bring it onto my computer, I'm able to see a lot of data in a very smooth way. So let's talk about bringing the data from the iBike onto your computer. The iBike includes a separate cable to which you attach the iBike, and the where you attach it looks exactly like the attachment point that would be on your handlebars. And then it's got a USB cable on the other end to attach it to your computer. And iBike software comes for Windows or Macintosh, but you should know that at this point, it is not compatible with the Intel Macs. Thought that was going to be a problem for me, but as you well know, I also run Parallels, which is Windows virtualization, on my Intel Mac. And so I've been using the iBike software under Microsoft Windows. It works very well. It's very easy to use. I will tell you that when I first set it up, I had a couple of setup issues with getting it configured on my Windows PC. I found that the iBike technical support was really excellent, walked me through the process very, very quickly, and I was up and running before I knew it. So if you have any problems, my personal opinion is don't hesitate to call their technical support. They're really, really good. And I've dealt with good tech support and bad tech support before, and they are definitely way up there on the good tech support end of the spectrum. So don't hesitate to give them a call. One issue that I do have with their software is that you can only display one ride at a time. We talked last week about the software that I've been using on my Mac called Ascent, which allows me to store multiple rides from my Garmin Edge product. Very similar to Garmin's product, you can look at a calendar view and you can look at a summary of a week or a month or just a day. On the iBike software, you are restricted to only looking at one particular ride. So they include a demo of the Cycling Peaks software. And if you want to look at summaries of days, weeks, months, then I think you're going to want to use Cycling Peaks. And I'm planning on reviewing Cycling Peaks on an upcoming show. Now, one thing that the iBike does not include, remember we talked about convergence a few moments ago and having as much of your data as possible being able to be displayed on one unit. The iBike does not include a heart rate monitor. And that's something that I would like to see in a future version of this product. That would make it an almost complete unit, replacing everything else that you've got on your handlebars, short of GPS, if that's something that you like. I would like to see heart rate included on the iBike. Another thing I'd like to see included on the iBike is wireless sensors. I have no doubt that if they added a wireless cadence and a wireless speed sensor to the iBike, it would probably increase the price of the product. I honestly believe that for those of us who have spent a lot of money on our bikes and want them to be as clean and lightweight as possible and look really, really good, because of course, a lot of times Freds want to look good, I think that wireless sensors would be a great way to go. Short of that, I think that the iBike really isn't missing anything that I would like to see in a cycle computer. Short of that, I think that it's easy to install and easy to use. And when you consider the fact that so many of the other power meters on the market require you to change a bottom bracket or change a wheel or to attach the sensor to your chain or whatever the other options are, this is very unobtrusive, very easy to install. And I think that that's what allows it to be one of the least expensive power meters on the market. That is also, of course, a positive feature of the iBike. Two other quick caveats that I might mention to you. First of all, the iBike does not come with a printed user manual. It comes with a quick start manual, but that really isn't sufficient for you to understand what you need to do to properly install and calibrate the iBike. It does come with a very complete and excellent manual on the CD-ROM that comes with the iBike. And of course, the CD-ROM also includes the aforementioned software for your Windows or Macintosh PC. But for me, I found that that was a little bit difficult to deal with because, of course, I don't normally keep my computer in the garage where I'm going to be installing a product. So I found myself sort of going back and forth and eventually just printing the manual out. Not really a big deal, but something that you should know about in advance. My recommendation would be once you get the product, pop the CD into your computer, print the manual out, and then take the entire manual with you out to your garage or wherever it is that you're going to install the product on your bike. Second, you need to be aware of the fact that the iBike will not work when you bring your bike inside on your indoor trainer. The speed sensor is on the front wheel, there's no wind, and there's no way for it to calculate speed or power when you've attached it to your indoor trainer. Personally, I think it's a minor point, but something which you should certainly know about before you go out and buy the iBike. Overall, I believe the iBike is a really great product and one which, if you don't want to change all those great parts that you've spent all that time and money accumulating and putting on your bike, if you don't want to add the extra weight of a special rear hub, or you don't want to change your bottom bracket, which of course for most people means professional installation, and if you want to spend a reasonable amount of money on a power meter, then I think the iBike is for you. I've been very happy using it on my bicycle. I'm very pleased with the amount of information that it gives, with the ease of setup and the ease of use, and I think that it is a fine quality product which is going to last for quite some time and one which I would recommend. With all that having been said, remember, I have several more power meters to review, and the next power meter that I will be reviewing is the Polar, the brand new model 600, which includes power, cadence, and heart rate all in one unit. So look for that in the coming weeks. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments about my review of the iBike power meter, please let me know. Send me an email, the email address, of course, thefredcast@gmail.com. And of course, I've put a link in the show notes to where you can find more information about the iBike on their website, and that's, of course, at ibikesports.com. While we're on the subject of products, I wanted to mention to you an update on a product that I talked to you about when I was at Interbike back in September, and that's the product called the spoiler by Slipstreams. As you'll recall, the spoiler was the product that mounts to your helmet straps, which allows the wind to be deflected away from your ear, thereby allowing you to hear what's going on around you even more. And if you're one of those people who wears headphones while you ride, it allows you to hear what's going on in your headphones better while still being able to hear traffic noise. They've now updated the spoiler product, and this is their second edition of the product, and they've made it easier to install, and they've also improved the way in which it deflects the wind around your ear. The spoiler retails for about $4.50 in the United States, $5.50 in Canada, or 3.7 euros. And you can find information at www.slipstreams.com. And of course, I have put a link in the show notes. And one more new product that I found out there that I thought I would mention to you. This one is called the Smart Cycle, and it's from Fisher-Price. And this is a, well, it looks like a stationary bike, sort of designed by Buzz Lightyear. It's got some fancy colors on it, and it's child size. It's made for a kid. And the way that it works, you're not going to believe this. It hooks up to a television, and it's intended to get your preschooler off the couch and off the floor and pedaling a bike. And they can use this bike to play games, video games, on the TV. You got to check it out. It's available this summer for about $100 from major toy retailers. And then you can get additional game cartridges for about $20. And the games can include Dora the Explorer, SpongeBob, Hot Wheels, Barbie. Check it out. I put a link in the show notes. And by the way, while we're talking about products, I want you to understand something. The products that I mention here on the Fredcast are mentioned solely because I find them interesting and because I think that you will also find them interesting. Unless I specifically mention that they are a sponsor, I want you to understand that I am getting no endorsement money and getting nothing from the manufacturers to mention the products here. I'm only doing it because I think that they're interesting and because I think that they should be mentioned for those of you that are out there that are Freds. So don't take any of these things as endorsements or that I've been paid to talk about these products. I just mention them because that's what we do here on the show. However, having mentioned that, there is one product that I will endorse and one that I hope that you'll consider buying yourself, and that is the new Fredcast socks. Of course, there's a link on the webpage at www.thefredcast.com. I noticed Fritz from Cyclicious got his socks, and by the way, he paid for them, and he mentioned them this week on his blog. So I appreciate that very much, Fritz. If you're interested in getting your pair of Fredcast socks, and they are going fast, please check out www.thefredcast.com. Click on the link and order yours today. Now, before we go, we're already almost an hour and 10 minutes into the show. It's been so long. I think that's one of the reasons why we've gone long tonight. I had a couple of voicemails from listeners that I thought you would be interested in hearing. So here is, first off, listener Anthony and then listener Josh with two recent voicemails that I received.
Hey, David. This is Anthony. I am still a Fred, though a very badly wounded Fred. I thought I'd share a quick story with you and a few rules that I am now going to learn to live by. I think maybe I'll publish a book of rules I've learned in 3 years of cycling. I'm actually in the hospital right now, and I've got a big piece of metal in my shoulder where my collarbone shattered and came through my shoulder 2 nights ago on a ride that I was unfamiliar with. And I guess therein lies the rub. I was training for my Tour de Cure 100-mile ride coming up on May 20th. And rather than my normal group ride, I hooked on to a group ride that I was unfamiliar with. And although the description said friendly, slow pace, and no drops, I quickly found myself about 15 miles into it being like one of only three people not dropped, or rather one of only three people who were dropped. So I turned to two people around me. I said, look, are any of you familiar with this ride? Does anybody know where we are? And they both said no. So I was feeling pretty strong, and I thought, well, let me bridge up to the group and try and catch them and find, you know, just tell them to slow down that we've got three people back here. Needless to say, this was not a good idea. I ended up going up over a hill, and on the descent, I could see the back of the group. So I thought, great, I'll catch up, tell them to slow down. And I ended up trying to take that turn at the bottom of the hill way too quickly. And Garmin tells me that at 38 miles an hour, my tires on that surface that day were not a good combination. So I ended up going off the road, flipping, and landing on my left shoulder. So I guess the most important rule that I've got here is, number one, do not ride aggressively on a ride which you are unfamiliar with. Seems simple, but boy, in the heat of riding, I guess we all forget. And number two, most important rule, and I've heard this debate going on your show and on the spokesman for months, wear a helmet. There's just no excuse for not wearing a helmet. I have to say that if I did not have my helmet on, I might not even be here talking to you right now, because I took the full brunt of the fall on my shoulder. But the next thing to hit was my head, and it slammed pretty hard into the rocks. So for me, there is no debate, and it's always wear a helmet. And again, unfamiliar rides, slow down, use caution, use better judgment than I did. Anyway, love the show, keep up the great work, and I will be back on my bike as soon as possible. I'm, I guess, a synonym for Fred is crazy, because I'm already, you know, talking to my orthopedic specialist here about, look, my ride's in 5 weeks, is there any chance, is there any chance? So I'm in good spirits and still dying to go ride, so maybe bad choice of words there. Anyway, thanks again for the show, keep up the great work, bye.
Okay, before we get to Josh's voicemail, I just have to jump in here and just wish Anthony my best wishes for a speedy recovery. And I'm as much as I'm very sad to hear about your accident, I am glad to hear that you are basically okay and that you will live to ride another day. So good luck in your recovery. Hope to hear that you're back on your bike really, really soon. All the best.
Hi, David. My name is Josh Whitmore. I live in North Carolina. I listen to the Fredcast quite avidly as I ride my bike and through these long winter training miles here in North Carolina. So I appreciate the product and keep up the good work. Hey, I wanted to bring up a topic for discussion, and that would be basic safety concerns on tour rides. I do a lot of racing. I probably do 50 to 60 USCF sanctioned road races and criteriums and time trials a year. I also do a fair number, probably about 10 benefit rides. These would be like centuries and fundraisers for certain causes and that sort of thing. And I've noticed a big difference in the safety management in those two types of events. I feel much safer in a USA Cycling or USCF sanctioned event. I feel like there are certain rules that the organizers must follow, and that the officials do a good job of trying to keep the riders as safe as possible. I find that in the organized tour rides or benefit rides, that those are far less managed, and there are no standards. And by far some of the scariest events that I've had experiences I've had in a group of cyclists have been on those type of events, mostly having to do with traffic control or lack thereof. Certainly tour riders are told at the beginning that to obey all traffic laws, but when there's 100 or 1,000 people parading through the streets of a town, it's almost impossible to do that. I just wanted to bring up that topic as a discussion of whether there should be more regulations, I guess, for safety of those kind of events, or whether that safety for those kind of events should be a higher priority for the promoters that put them on. I think they could take some lessons from the what is standard for the USCF races. So anyway, there you go. I'd like to just get the ball rolling on that and see if other people have had the same experience or what they think about that. I think there's some room for improvement, so thought that may help.
You know, I think Josh has a really good point here. And as somebody who organizes charity rides and participates in them and also organizes the safety and the training aspect of charity rides, this is a big concern to me as well. I'd like to hear from others out there in the Fredcast audience who have some comments about this, both about your experiences as well as with your suggestions on how charity rides can increase the safety of their riders. Because I think that this is something that a lot of us deal with when we do centuries and half centuries and metrics and doubles and all of that, whether it's a charity ride or just an organized ride, I think that it's true that when it comes to your recreational rider versus your racer, sometimes your recreational riders are not as safe. So how can you get that information to me? Well, as you can anytime you want to contact me, please do so via email. The email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. Of course, you can also send audio comments. And when it comes to this subject, I'd love to hear your audio comments so we can put them here on the show. Do what Josh and Anthony did. Call the Fredcast listener hotline at area code 206-203-FRED. And for those of you who are interested in following what's going on in the Fredcast and what's going on in my life, you can go to the Fredcast website. That's www.thefredcast.com. And that's, of course, where you'll find photos and show notes, show information. And also you can find the Fredcast forums where you can correspond with other Fredcast listeners. And if you're really interested in finding out what's going on in my life, you can follow me on Twitter and you'll find the links in the show notes as well as on the website. That's going to do it for tonight's show. We're already an hour and a quarter in. I'm sorry about the wait, and I'm sorry about the duration of the show. We'll be back again with another show. In the meantime, it's time for our PodSafe cycling music, as we do every week, and it comes to us, as always, from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Tonight's song is called Wednesday Morning, because this is probably when most of you are going to be listening to this, and it's by a band called Slack String. You can find links in the show notes to where you can find Slack String on iTunes, on Podshow, as well as on their own website. As always, thank you so much for listening and for staying subscribed. Please tell your friends about the show, write a review on iTunes, or go ahead and vote for us on Podcast Alley. No matter what you do, I'm glad that you enjoy the show and that you continue listening. Until next time, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.
Stepped out on my doorstep, Wednesday morning looked real fine. Took a glance at my wristwatch, 8 a.m. I read the time. I left my little girl sitting pretty in the bed. Stretched my arms, I touched the sky, time to clear my weary head. Wednesday morning, take my blues away. Wednesday morning, gonna be a brighter day. Wednesday morning, it's come so many times before. I used to frown upon my life, but I'm not going to anymore. I waved to Mrs. Johnson, I saw a schoolboy skipping by. Took a domer to my head, what a feeling, what a high. Clapped my hands, kicked up my feet, danced around the yard so sweet. I listened to the birdies sing, the music was a treat. Wednesday morning, take my blues away. Wednesday morning, it's gonna be a brighter day. Wednesday morning, it's come so many times before. I used to frown upon my life, but I'm not going to anymore. All the big bold words and prints. Prints so big, I'm so giant.